Blog Talk Radio.
Depressing as any week, but one in which so many issues have been brought to the forefront, so many different claims about terrorism, guns, and Muslims, Islam, radical Islam, security, how much the federal government should be listening in and on our conversations. I mean, huge number of issues coming out of the horrific events last Sunday morning in Orlando, where this Muslim nut went into a gay nightclub and shot up and killed 49 people. I mean, just think of the and injured 53, and just think of the evil. Just think of the evil that entails. He did this over a period of hours, shooting people in this head slowly while tweeting and calling his wife and texting and calling the police and all this going on. And just put yourself you can't do this, but kind of imagine what it is like to be in that position with a semi-automatic weapon, just shooting people. The kind of hatred and the kind of, I mean, the guy is sick by any standards of evil is just not enough to describe. I mean, this is personal. To shoot people close range like that, to watch them wither, to watch them suffer, to watch the blood flow, and to just nonchalantly walk around and keep doing it for hours. A horrific event that raises tons of questions. And you've seen that in the political response. You've seen that in the political response to what's happened. You've seen that in the response by the left. This is all about guns. We need to control guns. We need more gun control. How come a person like this has a gun, has access to a gun? How did a person like this work as a security guard? I mean, I have to admit, this doesn't exactly make me feel more comfortable when I see security guards out there. If somebody with his background, and we'll get into his background, in a little bit, but if somebody with his background could get a gun, could work in a security firm, I don't think any of us should feel safe out there. I mean, that is pretty scary stuff. Obama refusing to use the word Islam in the context of this, but recognizing it, at least it was terrorism. I was surprised by how quickly he recognized that this was an act of terrorism. But then succumbing to the pressure and admitting that he was Islam, but then defending Islam, and then, you know, back and forth. Donald Trump's hysteria and just ridiculous comments about this and other things, and the president of the United States these days, was in somehow in league with the terrorists, which is absurd and ridiculous politically. But just having no solution, like all other politicians, having no solution, not identifying what needs to be done, and so on. You know, I still see the left all over the place, the kind of the nihilistic left trying to argue that this is predominantly an issue of gay hatred. This was a hate crime. And again, given the complexity of this case and given what's really going on, that plays a role. But that can't be divorced from the fact that the guy was a Muslim and the approach Islam has, has to it. You know, the ongoing calls to ban Muslim immigration, the guy's an American. The guy was born in America. The San Bernardino shooters were born in America. So just a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff going on. Of course, on the right, what you got, and this is immediately after the attack and ongoing, and I still see it, constant discussion about what we need is more surveillance. What we need is more monitoring. What we need is to give more power to the NSA, to the FBI, to control us, to monitor us, to figure out who's who. And as if that is the solution, if the solution is more monitoring. So on. Look, and nobody, absolutely nobody in the entire political spectrum, which isn't surprising because is there even a political spectrum today? Is there really a difference anymore between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? Other than in the Donald Trump is a non-PC, outrageous, you know, crazy person. Is there really any difference politically in terms of actual action between them? Very, very little. Where do we go from here? How do we analyze this? How do we make sense of this? And what should be done? And how does one justify what should be done? That is, what is the logic behind? Many of you know what I think, but how do you justify it? I get a lot of pushback. Well, you know, I got some comments. How would bombing Saudi Arabia have prevented this? It actually would have, and I'll explain that. So today we're gonna dig deep into what happened in Orlando, dig deep into who this person was, into what inspires him, the effect that I think the continued success and the continued existence of ISIS and radical Islamic terrorist groups has, not just on Muslims, but generally on anybody who's a nihilist out there. We'll talk about what the solutions are. We'll talk about what the solutions are, why the only solution is the destruction of any kind of Islamic totalitarian organizations and entities that are dedicated to this the jihadi ideology, and how that would ultimately end these terrorist attacks. I mean, you'd still get random stuff because random stuff keeps happening, but you would not get the continued systemic. There are way too many of these kind of attacks going on today, and they're all connected. They're all connected to Islam, and they're all connected to radical Islam. They're all connected to a particular ideology, and that ideology has to be unequivocally discredited. And I think the only way to discredit it completely is to thoroughly, systematically defeat it. To completely defeat it, and by doing so, end its appeal. So let's dig in a little bit. There's a lot to say. We can also talk about gun control. We can talk about a bunch of things. And you, of course, are all invited to call 347-324-3075. 347-324-3075. Your thoughts on what happened to Orlando, causes, and the role ideology, the role guns have, feel free to call 347-324-3075. If you do call, press, I think, 1 in order for me to be able to see that you actually got a comment or a question that you want to participate. Otherwise, some people just call to listen into the show. It's hard with the software to differentiate between them. All right. What I think is interesting, and you know, we can start with this. One of the interesting things, a lot of interesting things, is kind of the background of this Omar Mateen, and the kind of life he has lived, and who he was. I mean, this is clearly a troubled individual. It's somebody who got into trouble at school over and over and over again. It is somebody who has been investigated and interrogated by the FBI twice. It's somebody that in high school in 2001 actually cheered as the 9/11 attacks were happening. He was cheering at a barbecue when he was in college, I guess, at a barbecue, a party. Some of his hamburger touched a piece of pork, and he threatened to shoot the partygoers and left in a row. So this is an unstable, crazy, nutty person who became more and more claimed on several occasions to know terrorists, but it seems like was making this up. Affiliated himself with both Al Qaeda and Hezbollah, one Shiite, one Sunni, not even really knowing the difference between the two. Just a messed up human being. Homophobic, as you know, hated gays, but also there's evidence to suggest that this is a guy who might have been gay and certainly was floating on online sites with other gay men. So and went to this a gay club on several occasions. It's not clear if he solicited anybody, but was somehow fascinated by this gay nightclub and kept returning it to it. So here's a guy who is clearly, he was disciplined at school 31 times in 7 years, hitting other students, was everybody describes him as a bully, as a troubled child, a scary. And this just continued throughout his life. It seems like became more and more serious about Islam over the years, particularly in the last few years, where he and he used Islam as clearly in this case. I think you've got a really, really, really troubled human being who then finds Islam because Islam justifies the fact that he's troubled and gives him censure to do crazy, nutty, evil things. You add to that the fact that he might have been a homosexual who his religion, right, the religion says that that is about as evil a thing as you can be, and yet he's struggling with being attracted to men, and at the same time, it is something evil that needs to be destroyed. Think about the psychological issues that are raised when you're living in that kind of a conflict, that kind of a conflict about your sexuality, about the life you're living, about the kind of life you should live. And, and then add to that religion, a religion that says, and the religion which then says, you know what, all those urges you have to hurt other people, All those urges you have to be mean and nasty and bad, they can all be justified. They can all be justified through a religion. They can all be justified through martyrdom. They can all be justified by claiming affinity to ISIS. They can all be justified by that because then when you die, you're going to go to heaven and you're going to get 72 virgins and all sins are wiped out. So Islam, in this context, this jihadism serves as a justification. Any nutcase, any crazy, any nihilist to go out there and destroy and kill in the name of their religion, whether one is really committed to the religion or not. Most of these guys, I don't think they study the religion qua religion. They adopt it. They manipulate it to serve their sick, crazy, horrible views, at least in this case. Some study Islam, commit themselves to jihad, and go out there and do what's necessary in order to fulfill their jihad. In this case, I find this case interesting because this is probably a case where jihad is an excuse for the fact that the guy's a complete nutcase anyway and was going to hurt people anyway, but this provided with an excuse to do it on a grand scale and feel no problem with that because he was using jihad as the kind of the explanation, the excuse for it. So, and again, this is not to whitewash jihadism. Jihadism is evil, and those in some terrorists clearly come to it purely out of the study of Islam and out of the study of jihad. This one, I believe, came to the study of jihad because it was an opportunity to find for committing evil acts, his own evil acts, doing what's evil. And this tells us, this suggests something really, really important, which I think we're going to see. And this is kind of crucial. The longer we let jihad survive, or the longer we let the jihadists thrive in places like Syria and Iraq under ISIS, or in Afghanistan under the Taliban and under Al-Qaeda, or in Iran under the guise of the Islamic Republic, or in Saudi Arabia under the guise of the Saudi monarchy and the Wahhabis, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, all these jihadi groups and jihadi-led governments in some way or another. As long as we allow these entities to survive as clear spokesmen and representatives of jihad, jihad meaning the fight in the name of Islam, the idea that Islam is justified, that Islamic totalitarianism is justified in taking over the world, that this is a global struggle between Muslims and the rest of the world, and killing because this is war is completely justified because there's a war going on, right? So as long as that ideology is allowed to thrive and succeed and survive in all these places right now, let's take ISIS as an example, that is going to inspire more and more and more Muslims to be radicalized and to go on jihad, but also just regular old nihilists, just regular old really, really bad, stupid people, evil people, to adopt these jihadi ideas to justify the fact that they just want to pick up a gun and shoot a bunch of people. Goes to the heart of the solution that I believe in, which is you have to deal with the enemy, with the real enemy, with the enemy that is constantly, daily, regularly fighting against you. Therefore, you have to deal with this global jihadi movement. You have to destroy it. You have to crush it. You have to turn it into dust. Otherwise, they will continue. They will continue without end to inspire these kind of shootings, and things will only get worse. They will not get better. They will only get worse because we will not do anything to prevent them in the future. And banning Muslim migration, banning all the stuff that Donald Trump is suggesting, increasing surveillance, will do zero, very little, if anything, to secure us from these kind of nut jobs. This will continue unabated until you deal with the problem where it lives, and that means until you deal with it, where ISIS and where the Islamists, the jihadists have been successful, which is overseas. So you cannot deal with it by focusing on America. It's not going to be solved by doing anything at home. All right, we'll get back to this issue. We'll get back to surveillance, NSA, and all of that, because it's the same kind of theme. And then I want to talk about what I would do, to solve this problem. You're listening to the Iran Book Show, and we're going to take a quick call here. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart, how's it going?
Hi, I'm doing well, and I'm glad you're touching on this and talking about how it's the ideas of Islam that we have to challenge and criticize, because I'm very concerned about this there is now a big movement in the United States, and Elon Journal talked about it a bit in his blog post, how now people are saying Islam has to be criticized, but I'm very worried because, you know, they had a very non-intellectual approach. You know, it's from this, you know, Trump represents what is being called the alternative right or the alt-right. And they seem to have completely taken over the Breitbart website with that Milo Yiannopoulos guy, you know, where, you know, they say there's a clash of civilizations between the West and Islam, but they don't talk about the ideas at all. They just, you know, they just say it's us versus them, and we have to stand up for the West. But when they say the West, they don't mean reason or individual rights or any of that. They just mean tradition for tradition's sake.
That's conservatives and conservatives about tradition, and they're not about what's essential regarding what the West is and what it isn't. And what you're right, what is missing to a large extent is ideas. What is missing is an alternative set of ideas, but also an ability to criticize Islam for the right reasons, to criticize Islam for its irrationality, for its violence, for its mysticism. And so many people on the right are afraid to do that because they're afraid to alienate their own religious allies, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm getting very worried about this because I'm seeing even like really respectable intellectual people sort of going in that direction, like with Mark Stein in Canada. You know, I've been reading him for a long time, and lately he's been, it seems to me that he says, yes, we need border control, you know, and he seems to be equivocating undocumented Mexican immigration, you know, with Islamists as if, you know, they're the same, in the same category, and they're not.
Yeah.
And I see people like Stephen Crowder, the conservative, you know, associating with Paul Joseph Watson, who actually works for Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist, and they go on to Stephen Molyneux's show. And that Stephen Molyneux guy, I mean, when he talks about how he wants to ban Muslims, he actually uses very explicitly eugenicist reasons. Stephen Molyneux says, every criminality is determined and violence is determined by IQ, and IQ is determined by genetics and race. So Stephen Molyneux says outright he wants to, you know, block Africans from coming to Europe because he thinks they're violent, and he says, well, there are racial and genetic reasons for it. And I get worried when people like conservatives are associating with that.
Well, I it doesn't surprise me, though, because, look, what we're living today is in a world where left and right have merged in their anti-intellectuality. What you have today is a spectrum of views that are all based on tradition, emotion. This is how it's always been said, always been done. This is not about ideas anymore. It's not about philosophy. There is no left and right in the sense of a Marxist left and a pro-capitalist founding fathers right. There is no ideology behind Donald Trump. There is no ideology behind these even the better defenders of or the better attackers of Islam. And there is no ideology on the left anymore. There is no consistent ideology. So it's all just emotion and whim. And some ideas that push people in one direction or another. And it's so easy for those who are nominally on the right to slip into racism and into eugenics and things like that. Because they're searching for allies somehow. And they'll take anybody as an ally. And it's one of the reasons I think we as objectivists need to be very, very, very careful in who we associate with. I would never associate with somebody like Trump. And I would never associate with a lot of people on the so-called right, because I think they fundamentally, philosophically, are the opposite of everything we believe in. Essentially, objectivism is about reason and individualism, individual rights. And nobody on the so-called right is for reason and individualism. And nobody on the so-called left is for reason and individualism. I mean, on the left, there's still a few people who believe they're for reason. And I think there's some hope for those people. But there is no reason in the debates going on today. There's no evidence. There's no attempt to really try to figure out what is happening. I mean, there's some articles that present this. The Wall Street Journal has been fairly good at presenting, but they don't come to any reasoned conclusion. It becomes, you know, this party versus that party. And God forbid, for example, right now, there's no discussion about guns. There's no debate about why somebody like Martine, who's clearly a sick human being, can get his hands on without any problem on an AR-15. An AR-15 designed for the sole function of killing people. You know, does that really make sense? Now, if you want to argue that we need to have the right to buy AR-15s because we have to defend ourselves against the government, then, you know, maybe that's an argument, but there's no discussion. There's just, I have a right, you know, I have a right to any gun I want. And this was all caused by guns, and it's just, you know, it's just slogans people are throwing out there left and right. So in my view, the whole debate is ridiculous that's going on today. And the right is being sucked into a place where it shouldn't be. And this is why Trump is being so successful, and the left has nothing new to bring to the table, which is pathetic. They want us to basically roll over and die. So the whole debate today is very disheartening.
Well, right. I'm grateful that you're here talking about it.
Well, yeah, but nobody's, very few people are listening. So it's kind of depressing, but okay. I don't want to inflict my depression on all of you guys. Thanks, Stuart, for calling. I really appreciate it. And thank you all guys for listening. So I'm not implying that you guys are not important by saying that nobody's listening. You guys are listening, and that's important, and that's of incredible value. And you know, thousands of people are listening to the show. So we're having some effect. Not everybody agrees with me on this show, but that's good too. Hopefully I'm getting some of you to think. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about you're going to talk more about these issues. I want to talk about the responses. I want to talk about the reactions. I want to talk about gun control, and I want to talk about what needs to be done and how we could win this easily and quickly, and just the astounding fact that our leaders are cowards and the people – you know, not just our leaders, of course, they do, in a sense, what the people want them. We as a culture have become a culture of cowards.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth, and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
All right, let me repeat something I've said about politics before. I see on the chat there's quite a bit of discussion on who's the better candidate, Trump or Cruz or Fiorina or whatever. I think it's important to repeat something I said a long time ago about evaluating political candidates. And let me start by this. They're all really, really, really bad, all of them. And you have to start with that. Because they are, objectively. Donald Trump is an authoritarian thug. The idea that somebody as gross, as thuggish, as authoritarian, as unthinking, as angry, as unprincipled, as unpredictable would be our presidential candidate is unthinkable. Now, in the end, you might conclude that he's better than Hillary. But you have to start with, he is really, 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 really bad. It would be horrible to have him as president of the United States. He is, the defining characteristic of Donald Trump is he is an authoritarian. That is the defining principle. And if that's the direction you want to take the country, vote for Trump, right? Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is a religious nut. He placed his religiosity front and center. He made it all about religion. He bashed gays. He went after gay marriage. But more than that, the statement that would make it impossible for me to be a crusading Cruz supporter was that it was a statement he made about every president should start his day on his knees. On his knees. Right? So if you're going to endorse Cruz, and I'm not saying you can't endorse Cruz, to be objective, you have to start by saying he's really, 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 really bad. He is a religious nutcase. He associates with people who are crazy evangelical nuts. But given how bad the selection you do not pick a presidential candidate by making a list of all the concrete issues that exist and checking off the things you agree with and checking off the things you don't agree with. That is a concrete bound anti-intellectual, anti-philosophical approach. You start with fundamental ideas. What are the ideas, if they are any? What animates this candidate? What are the fundamental ideas of this? What is this candidate's philosophy. You stole with that. Because politicians lie all the time. You know, Donald Trump's a great example of that. He changes his mind all the time. Every day, almost, he changes his mind. So you don't know what they're going to actually do when they get into office. They're going to be guided by certain ideas. What is the nature of those ideas? And the defining characteristic of Donald Trump is his authoritarianism. The defining characteristic of Cruz as he made it was his religiosity. And I don't care if I agree with 80% of what Cruz said. I do. A lot of his concrete issues were pretty good. The way he defined himself was being guided by the Spirit, was being guided by God. God spoke to him every day when he read the Bible. All right, so you know that's my view. I think objectivists make and those who believe in liberty, those who believe in ideas, make a huge mistake by endorsing anybody. By getting excited about anybody, I've said this all along, by getting excited about anybody, and by not approaching it philosophically. Remember that Ayn Rand was opposed to Ronald Reagan, and in the big picture, she was absolutely right. Looking back, she was absolutely right. In this election, to choose and to get excited about a choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is nuts. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to choose, but to get excited about that choice and to lobby for that choice is nuts. Again, the essential characteristic of a Donald Trump, and I know objectivists all, there are some objectivists who are very supportive of him. The essential characteristic is authoritarianism, and authoritarianism will crush this country, will destroy this country, more so than any concrete policy here or there. Hitler was non-PC. Stalin was non-PC. Every fascist nut is non-PC. The fact that somebody is non-PC is not a good thing or a bad thing. It depends on what motivates his PC, is non-PC, what he uses it for. If he uses it to randomly insult women, I don't consider that a virtue, but a vice. So, you know, and again, the statements, the unprincipled, concrete boundness of Donald Trump's statements, and with regard to the Orlando massacre, you know how one could support that, I don't understand, and I do not know. We've got a caller. Let's take the caller. Hi, you're on Brook Show. Who's this? Hello?
This is Nick. Hello.
Hey, Nick. How's it going?
Pretty good. I was actually calling to take you to task for the gun, although it wasn't a big deal. You said something about guns that I wanted to discuss. But you just brought up Trump, and you mentioned a lot of points, and I don't know which to talk about, but... First off,
oh, we can do them all. I'm eager to talk about guns, but we can talk about Trump as well.
I can. Okay, great. I can hit him
with
quick.
Trump. I'm on a roll on Trump. So, you can start with Trump.
Because I think this is all rationalization. People hate Trump because of his vulgarity or politically incorrectness, or I don't know a word I can sum up all that in one word. But and then they rationalize all the other policies because as far as it goes, if you take away all that stuff, the vulgarity, if he behaved like a normal politician without the controversial statements, none of his politics issues, flip-flops, anything would be any different than any other politician, except that the people are upset and freaking out because he says things that upset everybody, and then they write about it, misrepresent it.
So let's take what you said, because there's some truth to what you're saying. So let's take his positions. All politicians flip-flops are fine, so we're not going to get too excited, although I think he flip-flops particularly. Right. He flip-flops with grandeur because he's so loudmouthed and so obnoxious that he broadcasts his flip-flops in ways that nobody else does. But But let's take his actual positions. If Donald Trump was not the loudmouth, vulgar, authoritarian type that he is, nobody would vote for him because his positions are at worst just statist, on their face through and through just statist, and at best just conventional, just like any moderate Republican. There's nothing unique about his positions on any issue. He was just like every other Republican on immigration. He just said it in a bigger voice and was bigger loudmouth about it. Go ahead.
I was going to say he his uncompromising look. This is the way it is. This is what I think. And I have.
Yeah,
right,
but again,
to
now
opinion,
you're talking about tone.
And
now you're talking about tone and his bombast. I'm talking about just purely
that's
the
99%
position. They're all flip floppers. Yeah. If he was actually president, I don't believe he'd build a wall, and I don't believe anything would happen with immigration any different than it is today. Maybe at the margins. He's not going to round up 11 million. But that's not the point. The point is that just looking at his positions, they're just conventional. So take his position on trade. His position on trade is Bernie Sanders. It's not anywhere in a pro-freedom, pro-capitalist position. It's pure socialism. It's pure Bernie Sanders. His position on losing jobs is pure Bernie Sanders.
I agree with all that. I agree with all that. My point is that we're discussing why all the crazed, hysterical. Like, how is he authoritarian?
He's authoritarian partially because of his style. His style is to shout you down. His style is not to make an argument. He's authoritarian.
How does he not make an argument? So Hillary is authoritarian too. She doesn't even answer anybody. He doesn't make any kind of argument. He defends himself. He retaliates when people say anything. All the vulgarity examples. Even you mentioned that you say that he says bad things about women. Like he sits there randomly, just some woman comes along and he randomly says something bad about her. Every example of his attack on women are retaliations. Rosie, have you watched the YouTube of Rosie O'Donnell?
But he makes them personal, right? He didn't have to talk about blood with Megyn Kelly.
Right. So
Megyn Kelly didn't make a personal attack on. He didn't have to talk about how Fiorina looks. I mean, it's not that's not retaliation. That's the way.
That's a little. I agree with that.
That's the way a schoolyard bully who does not accept an argument. He will not argue with anybody. As soon as you argue with him, he makes it personal. As soon as you argue with him, he puts you down, and he makes an ad hominem attack. That is a characteristic of an authoritarian.
Oh.
Of course it is. That's exactly what he does. If you
look
at the debate over and over again, that's exactly what he does.
That's 99% of politicians. Nobody look at global warming. Nobody argues any facts on anything. In that regard, everybody's authoritarian. The only difference is that Trump has a pulpit, a bully pulpit. He's famous, and people hear him. He makes news, so everybody gets to hear him, and that's why everybody's freaking out. And he doesn't lose popularity when he gives his opinion.
Watch
the YouTube video on Rosie O'Donnell. Watch the heinous thing she said about him. I would have said the same thing about her. Look, if you say bad things about me, I can come back at you and say bad things about you. Now, I agree. The blood comment about Megan, I would not have said that.
Would you have said that Fiorina's ugly?
Coming back
would
and
you
calling
said, running
Elizabeth
for president,
Warren,
would you have said Fiorina's ugly? I mean, you wouldn't have done it. It strikes me as nuts.
Let me
agree with you on something. Yeah, they're all authoritarian to some extent or another. They're all authoritarian. The difference is that he is out there. He is making it the feature of his campaign. He's not apologetic. Plus, he goes after journalists. He goes after anybody in a brutal way.
I agree. I'm glad you brought that example up. He called the journalist a sleaze. And the whole media talks about, oh, my God, look at Trump calling people sleazes, how bad.
But that's not what I'm talking about.
Not a single paper.
That is not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
That's
right,
not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about
so
the
you agree
fact
with that
he,
one?
I think a presidential candidate shouldn't call a journalist a sleaze. I don't think that's appropriate. I think it's stupid, and I think it suggests a primitive mentality. That is not presidential, and I would never vote for somebody who did that. So You know, it is insane. But that is not the issue. The issue is that he has said that he wants to expand libel laws so people cannot criticize him. That he wants to, that he criticized journalists not for the facts that they present, but for the actual criticism of his. The fact that he praises Putin. The fact that when he's presented with the idea that Putin kills journalists, Donald Trump says, well, everybody kills people, so what? I mean, the guy is an authoritarian. He expects you to accept what he says on face value. Now, all of them are authoritarian. Granted, that's the nature of politics today. But he is an authoritarian in your face. And what makes him appealing to people is authoritarianism. And his vulgar language is a part of that authoritarianism. It's not separate. He uses non-PC not to make an argument, but to insult, to bombast, and to attract attention to himself. That is his primary goal.
That's one of my pet peeves, ad hominem attacks. And I have never seen him make an ad hominem attack. I don't think calling Rosie O'Donnell a pig is ad hominem. An ad hominem attack is when you don't argue back. You just use that and use that as a refutation. I've never seen him do that. You're allowed to call people names who insult you and write lies about you in the paper. Now, the only thing I agree with you is it's unpresidential to do it yourself, but I think it needs to be done. Hillary doesn't have to worry about this. Everything she has written about her is great. She doesn't have to worry about that. But the lies that they say about Trump, and here's another example, for instance, and it's nothing to do with Trump. The Lucifer comment about Ted Cruz, for instance. You remember that one?
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead.
Can you guys hear me now? This should work. Now, is there anybody? 1, 2, 3, sound. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Okay, we got the sound back. Sorry about that. Nick, sorry, I did not cut you off. It was Donald Trump. He already is controlling this station, and this just proves that he is an authoritarian because he didn't want me criticizing me. Anyway, I apologize for that. Don't know what happened. I had to kind of log off and log back on, and now it's working again. Okay, I'm not going to get into a long debate here about Donald Trump, and I'll go back to Nick to talk about guns in a minute. But let me say this. Donald Trump represents everything about authoritarianism and a fascist-like attitude to politics, and his non-PC is part of that. It is part of that attitude. His emphasis on the hatred of the other. You should hate the Chinese, you'd hate the Japanese, you should hate the Mexican, is authoritarian. An authoritarian is somebody pose his views on you. An authoritarian who's somebody who does not debate, discuss, use logic and reason, but wants to impose his view on you. And to give a person like that political power is scary. Now, granted, they're all authoritarian to some extent, but Donald Trump is particularly bad because of his anti-intellectualism and because he is more authoritarian and is using emotion and fear as his primary mechanisms by which to encourage people to vote for him. Emotion and fear are what characterizes most authoritarian, fascist, neo-fascist type politicians. And it stuns me that you guys don't see it. And I'm sorry that you guys don't see it. But that this is exactly what he is. He is all about using fear, using collectivistic arguments, but using fear and using hatred of the other to pursue his agenda, authoritarians, when you meet somebody and you say that person's, one of the characteristics is thin skin, people who cannot listen to criticism of themselves without lashing out, people who cannot deal with an actual debate and an actual argument, but immediately revert to personal insults. That is a sign of low self-esteem. That is a sign of inability to actually consider consider arguments. I don't believe Donald Trump. The other aspect of this is you know, it relates to this flip-flopping, which I think is, you know, they all politicians do it. I think he does it more than others. He panders and flip-flops, but I think he does it because he's it's about power. Again, typical of all politicians. But if you take him on the issues, on the actual issues, he's one of the worst. Just on the issues, put aside authoritarianism, put aside all the other aspects of this. Just on purely the issues, I can't think of a Republican who's been worse. Just on the issues, he hates bankers. He hates Wall Street. He has explicitly said that he will not reform Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, that he would not touch them. He makes a big deal out of that. He has, there's a few things he says about foreign policy that are pretty good, but on pretty much everything else that he says, you know, he's bad. Now, granted, at the end of the day, you might vote for him because you might decide he's better than Hillary. But all I'm asking for is objectivity. All I'm asking for is to recognize that it's not about all, you know, check boxes around concrete ideas. It's about the ideology that's driving. It's about the essence of what this human being is about, what he's going to be as president. And I'm not saying I'll never vote for Donald Trump, but it's a question of putting it in an objective context. Right. And I think, based on the comments, I don't think people are putting it in an objective context and viewing this objectively. He might be the lesser of evils. I'm not sure he is, but he might be. Nick is here. Let's say you want to talk about guns. Nick, are you still
on? Yeah, and the same thing happened again. I can't let one last point go on the Trump thing.
Yeah,
because this is 100%. How can you think he's a racist? Just because
did I say he's a racist? Didn't say he's a racist.
Oh, no, you just said something about Chinese and Mexican. He plays other groups.
He uses the other. He uses us versus them. It's an old fascist trick. It's what fascists did to the Jews constantly, and now he's using the thing that Americans fear, which is Chinese, Japanese taking our jobs, the Mexicans invading our country and going to destroy this country. He uses that, and he uses it in a way that I've never seen an American politician use, and in a disgusting, horrific way. And he does it in a way, again, the same as fascists do. It's not our fault. You Americans are good. You're all fine. It's those people over there. They're screwing us, and that's what's caused the decline of America. Now, that's wrong on its face, but it also is a political tactic. It is disgusting.
Yeah, but he's just talking about illegal Mexicans coming in, and we need to stop that. We need to secure the border. Now, I agree it's not a fundamental problem. I think in a less fair capitalistic society, you should have open borders.
And it's,
and we
it's
wouldn't
more
have
than
a problem
not
with the Muslims
a fundamental problem. It's not the reason America is in decline. It's not a big problem one way or the other. And he's made it into this massive
problem. But you
can
be rational and address that one issue, right? You can be rational and not be playing.
Yes,
you can.
And if he only did it on Mexicans, I'd agree with you. But he does it on the Chinese. He does it on Japan. And he does the same thing on the Chinese and the Japanese. And then the way he does it on Muslims is non-objective. It's not right. And again, he's using this. So he uses the same tactic over and over and over again. I see a pattern. That's what I think you need to do. You need to look for patterns, and that's a pattern.
Do you have an episode on Trump or an article on Trump where you have – do you have an episode or an article on Trump where you have all
if you look
your
at the episodes,
beliefs?
If you look at the list of episodes, I've done at least a couple on Trump.
You might have to do another couple.
That's fine. He's running for president. I think I'm going to have to do another couple, and it seems like people like him. So But I'm happy to pull out his statements, to put out exactly what he says about how the Chinese and the Japanese are screwing us, and how it's all their fault, and America would be great if only the Japanese and the Chinese stopped screwing us. Really? Give me a break. It has nothing to do with Washington and what Washington's doing to us. It has nothing to do with the Republican Party screwing us for all these years and the Democratic Party screwing us even more. Really? That's what it is?
As long as you don't think he's a racist, that's what I want to point out.
I have to say, I don't know if he's a racist. I don't think he's in anything. I think he's a loudmouth emotionalist who will say anything that I think will lead him to be successful politically. I have no respect for this man. If you haven't, I've never liked him. I certainly don't like him as a politician. And everything I've seen him, every time I see him in the debates, every time I see him give a speech, every time I look at his Twitter feed, I'm appalled that this man is a candidate for the presidency of the United States.
Okay, well, let's move on to guns.
That's where something is now you really disagree on, like guns.
I didn't think we disagreed until I heard a couple of comments, but I wasn't sure what you meant by them 100%. The assault, first of all, you say that both the one side says one thing, you kind of insinuated that we're not talking to each other correctly. The right, the pro-gun side is 100% correct. Now, obviously, certain people are wrong, but in general, the right side, the gun pro-gun side, I can take a random person at a gun rights rally, and I bet you they would be able to debate anybody, a politician, on these issues. I wouldn't say the same thing about environmentalism or other political things, but gun rights, they know their issues, and they are 100% right, and this is the easiest thing to defend.
I don't think that's true, and I don't know what the argument is. So let's take this issue. Let's take a simple issue.
Okay.
People on the FBI on the terrorist watch list, should they be banned from buying guns?
Okay, now you caught me at a point here. I don't know what that watch list means. Is this kind of like the watch list that had
let's
Ted Kennedy on the list?
Let's say it's a pretty big one. It's not very specific. It might include people who are innocent. It probably does include, and mistakes are made.
Right. So then I would say no, absolutely not.
See, I would say yes.
I would say no to that.
I would say yes. If you're on that watch list, if it's enough for people to be watching you, then you shouldn't be just able to walk into a gun store and buy a gun.
Right. Okay, but
should people be allowed to buy tanks?
No.
Okay,
only what's required objectively to defend myself in a situation. So I always say the people talk about the assault rifles. Why do you need that? Why do you need that? First of all, I shouldn't have to defend myself in terms of that. But as to why I would need, here's the
answer.
But
you just said you didn't need to defend yourself. Let me just catch you at this. You just said you didn't need to defend yourself because it had to be a weapon that you would need for self-defense. So that needs to be a defense, right? Because there's certainly classes of weaponry that we both agree should not be sold in the open market.
Correct. And the line is drawn to what you objectively need. Now, an assault rifle is useful if you have, say, you can imagine a situation where five people are trying to break down your door. They might all be armed. Now, this doesn't happen often, but it might happen. It's not insane for it to happen. And a handgun's not going to cut it. Most bullets miss. Even the ones that hit, it's not like the movies. People don't drop dead immediately. Sometimes
I know. I've shot assault rifles and I've shot.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've used these weapons. I know. But look.
Okay, great.
So granted, okay, but that's not the argument I see online, right? It's not the argument I see the right make. And you said what is objectively required for people to defend themselves. Great statement. I agree completely. I like that statement. Although I still think the government should do background checks, and not everybody should be able to get what's objectively required for their own self-defense, because not everybody can be trusted to defend themselves. There should be some background checks. But I agree with that statement. I don't hear that statement in the debates going on at all. What I hear is what I hear a lot from libertarians in particular. We need this in order to fight the government, right? Really? I mean, then you should legalize tanks.
Okay.
Because I need a tank to fight the
guy. I misspoke again on that too, because that one I hear all the time, and they're wrong about that. To me, unless you have tanks, even tanks wouldn't help you. How can you fight the government if they have an army? That's ridiculous.
I know.
I always throw that out. But I throw that out. But I forgot about your soldier your army background. And so you obviously, I thought you were making the mistake about assault rifles and AR-15s, and people are confused by the definitions of all these. And nobody, but obviously you don't.
No, I know an AR-15. I lived with an AR-15 for at least in a tank corps. I lived with an AR-15 for 9 months, literally lived with it. And so I know an AR-15.
You know the difference between a semi-automatic. You know the difference between
an
semi-automatic.
Yeah, and
offset
to be semi-automatic.
Right.
But also in the military, they teach you that you almost never set a gun to automatic and fire it. So when you're in combat, an automatic weapon is always set to fire it semi-automatic, because you can't hit anything if you put it on automatic, and you lose control over it. So, and you're wasting bullets, and you might do it to frighten somebody, to scare somebody, but if you actually want to kill people, you put a gun on semi-automatic. Look, I know guns. I know what they're meant for. An AR-15 is a shortened M16. That's what it is. We called them shortened M16s in the Israeli army. And now I've learned that they call them AR-15s here in the United States. But
rifles. And the definition of that is scary looking gun that I'm afraid of. That's really the definition.
Well, no, I don't think
that's
completely fair. That's not completely fair. An assault rifle was designed for battle, and these guns are designed for battle. They're not designed primarily. I own a Glock, right? My Glock is designed for self defense. It's not designed for battle. An AR-15 is designed for battle. I can also use it for self defense, and I accept that you could make an argument that it's objectively necessary for my self defense. I'm not going to argue against that. But it wasn't designed to be self-defense. It was designed to be a combat weapon. It's an assault rifle. I completely accept that as a definition of it.
But what is the difference between that and a hunting rifle with the same dimensions, with the same caliber bullet? And is it just a matter of clip size?
You don't hold a hunting rifle the same way as you hold an AR-15, you don't use it in the same way. You don't aim in the same way. I mean, these are if you look at a hunting rifle and you look at an AR-15, they're designed differently. The AR-15 is much lighter generally because you're running in battle and so on. I mean, there are a lot of differences, and I'm not a gun expert, so I don't want to make myself out to be a gun expert. I'm not. I use guns in the Israeli army, very big guns, very small guns, and I've used AK-47s, AR-15s, but I'm no expert on these things. And I would take an AK-47 any day over an M16 or AR-15 as a self-defense weapon or any kind of weapon, because you know it when you pull the trigger, it's actually going to fire. But my point is this. I'm fine with having that discussion, and I think we should have a discussion about what qualifies as objectively necessary or objectively necessary if he wants to own self-defense. And that's a debate that should happen. I don't see people having that debate.
You have to be for that if you're for individual rights.
Yeah,
I
agree
with
that.
As a matter of fact, the police are under no obligation to, as they showed in the Orlando situation and other situations, they actually do not have to put their lives at risk. If your family is getting shot up in a building and the police arrive 10 minutes later, unless you go in, it's not going to, they're not going to go in.
Look, I not only that, but they're likely to prevent you from going in. But that's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
I agree with you. So, but that's the kind of debate that needs to happen. Okay, so these are the standards. Self-defense is a right. What then qualifies? What with recognizing that the state has a role here. The state has a role here because it is the agency at the end of self-defense, right? So it has a role, and that role doesn't eliminate your responsibility to defend yourselves, but there is a role here, and let's debate what that role is exactly. Let's define where that line is between what is necessary for self-defense and what isn't necessary for self-defense, and let's do it rationally. I don't see that debate happening. That's not the debate that is happening right now. It just isn't, unfortunately.
One more.
one more thing on these mass killings too. Everyone except for the Arizona, I don't know if she was a governor, the Arizona politician.
She was a congressman.
She was the only example of a mass shooting or whatever you call them, where it was not a gun-free zone. Every mass shooting has to be ended, usually, not everyone, but most are ended by a bullet, usually from a police officer since it's in gun-free zones. If we did not have these gun-free zones, and there are situations where people actually said, they've interviewed these people, and they said they avoided, I think it was the Batman Arkansas the Batman killer. I forgot where it took place.
Yep.
Oh, Denver, and he said he avoided a theater that did not have a gun free zone. So
it was the Colorado shooter in Aurora,
right.
Colorado. No, I think that's right. But let's also remember that there was a gun at the nightclub. It was a security guard, and as you have mentioned, most bullets missed. He actually fired at the guy and missed him. And by that time, the guy had gotten in and had taken hostages. So there was a gun. But I this is a point I wanted to bring up earlier. I mean, to me, it's astounding that you have a place with 300, 350 people and nobody jumped this guy. The likelihood you're going to die is true, but you're probably going to die anyway. Jump this guy. I mean, to me, it's astounding how many of these mass shootings happen where people don't act. Now, some of the schools, you've seen teachers do it, or teachers blockade the doors, or all kinds of stuff. But here, there were 350 people versus one. Even with a 30-round clip, the guy had to take time to take out a clip and put a new one in. Nobody jumped him while he was doing that. And to me, that's pretty astounding.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
You mentioned the security guy. One last, I'm sorry, I'm hogging your time. One last point. The security guy is usually the first to go in these mass killings. And I just want to, one last point. You've heard of John Lott, right? The gun guy who writes all the books on guns.
No, I don't know. No, I haven't. I don't do much on guns.
He'd be a good interview.
It's not an area that particularly interests me.
He wrote the book More Guns, Less Crimes, and he's a statistician. I don't know exactly his place, but he has written a book that shows the statistics show that anywhere there's more guns, there's less crime, believe it or not.
Yeah, I'm going to admit that I don't completely believe it. And I've seen refutations of that statistically. I generally am worried about when people present statistics because I know how they can be used, but we live today. Europe today has very little guns, and it's much less violent than the United States. Now, it's a different culture, and you know it's hard to control for these things, but that's true of other studies as well. We live today in the world in peaceful, probably in terms of violence, the most peaceful era in human history, maybe. Fewer people die from violence today in the world than in any period in human history. Is that because we have a lot of guns? Or is that because of other things? I suspect it's because of other things. Generally, violence is overstated in our society. We live in a relatively – this is why I've never carried a gun until recently. It's because I feel safe. I don't feel like I need to. We live in an unbelievably safe environment in a safe place in the world right now. And we should
Thank
learn to
much.
Appreciate that. Sure. Thank you. Thanks for calling, Nick. Appreciate it.
All right.
All right, so way off topic, I guess. Well, we stayed on topic somewhat. We went off topic somewhat. That's good. But a good call, Nick. I appreciate it. And some good arguments there. Let me see. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. And actually, we have to wrap up the show already. It went by fast, partially because of that break in audio. But let's take a short break.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, who cares? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, so let's get back to the topic in terms of and let's shift a little bit to solutions because I think that's important, and that's where objectivism has something unique to say about this. And let me first say the solution cannot be banning guns. Banning guns won't prevent these kind of things. Bad guys can get guns no matter what, and you know, as Israel has found out, they can use knives. They can use as we discovered, they can use airplanes. There is no way to you know, just blaming the weapon is not going to generate the kind of the peaceful result that we want. And indeed, I would like to live in a world, and I've said this also, I would like to live in a world where I didn't feel like I needed to carry a gun because it was safe. And until recently, I didn't feel like I needed to carry a gun, and I didn't, because I live in a very safe neighborhood, in a very safe part of the world. You know, I've lived in dangerous places in the world. It's called Israel. I know what the difference is. For the probability of one a gazillion that I would need a gun to defend myself, I didn't purchase a gun. And I wish that we all lived in such places. And I think there would be a lot less guns out there for self-defense. And I don't think that would encourage the bad guys, because I don't think it's the lack of guns which is what encourages bad guys. I think what encourages bad guys are bad ideas, bad philosophy. I now carry, I don't carry a gun, but I now have a gun because After San Bernardino, after Orlando, after, you know, what we write about tourism and what we write about other issues, I think there is a non-trivial, it's still tiny, but it's a non-trivial probability that I would be attacked after what happened in Garland, Texas. Scares me more than anything is not just the prevalence of these attacks. It's the fact that we're doing nothing about it. That is, that attacks are intensifying, and yet the response is pathetic, both on left and right. So banning guns is not going to solve the problem. Bad guys always find a way to get guns. Bad guys always find a way to kill you if they want to kill you, right? Second, the right has it completely wrong. The right wants to monitor us more. It wants to enhance the powers of the NSA, enhance the powers of the FBI. It wants to control us more. It wants to monitor what we do more. And, you know, that's wrong. That's an authoritarian response. Oh, and the right wants to ban all Muslims from coming into the United States, which is wrong and stupid for a variety of different reasons. You know, and I'm fine with banning Muslims from coming into the United States if we prosecuted a proper war. Otherwise, they're going to find a way to get in here anyway. It's not hard to cross the border into the United States if you really want to. Wall or no wall. And this is the lesson of Israel. I'm not for the wall in Israel. I think the wall is a sign that we've lost. And it's a sign in Israel that Israel has lost. Israel built a wall because it wasn't willing to do what was necessary to win. And the wall, there's still terrorism in Israel. There's going to continue to be terrorism in Israel. It's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. The wall will actually make it worse because the terrorists will find ways to lob really bad stuff over the wall. Walls are not solutions. Walls are strategies of defeat. Walls are declarations that we've lost. And that's what Trump is declaring to the world, the fact that the United States has lost. When Rome built a wall, it was a sign of its own demise. Its own demise was coming. And this goes on. Now, so what is the solution? The solution is not to increase bombing on ISIS. The solution is not to get rid of Assad, which is the latest thing coming out of the State Department. We have to destroy Assad. The solution is to destroy one's enemies. But to do that, one first has to define one's enemies, to identify one's enemies. And as I've said many times, it doesn't help to say the enemy is Islam, because there are 1.4 billion Muslims in the world. They are not your enemy. Yes, philosophically, the ideology of Islam is the enemy. But practically, politically, militarily, the enemy is jihadism, Islamic totalitarianism. You got to identify them and you got to go kill them. ISIS is the enemy. Bombing it isn't going to do anything. Bombing it to weaken them so you can bring in ground troops to wipe them out, sure. But you got to wipe them out. You got to crush them. You got to take away all their territory. Not one square mile should remain. Because as long as they hold territory, they are victorious. They are winning. They will inspire. They will inspire the various types of nihilists, evil, man-hating creatures like this guy in Orlando to go out there and shoot up a nightclub. You have to destroy them. Right? And then you have to look at who supports them. Who gives them money? Who gives them ideological support? Who inspires them? And on the Sunni side, all that inspiration, all that money, all that ideological support comes from one country, and that's Saudi Arabia. And now people say how it's bombing Saudi Arabia. Stop, right, Orlando? It would, because it would say your cause is futile. You will never win. Nobody goes out and tries to die for a cause that is a loser. What motivates these people, what inspires these people, what gets them really high is the idea that the cause will win, that something continues after their life and they are one more, you know, cause of the great victory of Islam in the world. So of course there's a cause and effect. Of course bombing Saudi Arabia would reduce this. And then of course you have to take over, you have to do the same to the Iranians, because the Iranians fund all Shiite terrorism. They fund it, they support it, they inspire it. And for many people, certainly in Al-Qaeda originally, they didn't care about the Sunni-Shiite split. What they care about is Sharia law. And that's why the Iranians and Al-Qaeda, at least initially, cooperated. And this is why Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, was so pissed off at Al-Qaeda in Iraq when Al-Qaeda in Iraq turned it into a sectarian issue when they started bombing Shiites. The Bin Laden chastised them on that. So you've got to take out the adherence of Sharia law. You've got to take out, destroy those that inspire these kind of attacks. I mean, think about it. We have in the United States the mightiest military force in human history. And we do nothing. They come, they kill us. They say it's inspired by Islam. They say they're inspired by ISIS. And we do nothing. 75% of the sorties of the flights to bomb ISIS return without dropping a bomb because of rules of engagement. I mean, that's absurd. That's absurd. You either fight to win or you don't fight. And that means you lose. And what we're doing is not fighting, so we're losing. So Americans are dying for nothing. That's the problem I have on the right, is that they blame Obama for all this. Well, what did George Bush do? And George Bush wouldn't recognize the Islamic nature of the enemy any more than Obama does. Indeed, Obama has used Islamic radicals more times than Bush did. Bush, for 1 week, called them Islamic fascists and then stopped. So there is no right or left on this issue. They're all wrong. There's and the libertarians, of course, worse than everybody else. That's the problem with Gary Johnson. Only objectivism says it's an ideological enemy. All those animated by the ideology are evil and are the enemy, and they need to be destroyed unequivocally by use of whatever military force is necessary in order to destroy them, and that their existence, their very existence, is what animates all these so-called lone wolf, self-radicalized people. And by the way, every radical mosque that I've heard of in the United States, every radical mosque, including the mosque in Orlando that brought in the preacher that advocated for killing gays, which happened about a week or two before the killings, right? Every one of those mosques is funded by the Saudis. If they're Sunni, if they're Shiite, they're funded by the Iranians. Many of our preachers in the United States, including military preachers, including prison preachers, were trained and funded by the Saudis. The Saudis fund all the madrasas in Pakistan. There are thousands of them today. 40, 50 years ago, there was like a dozen. Now there are thousands of them, all funded by the Saudis. Now, I'm kind of covering under the Saudi umbrella Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and maybe Kuwait and so on. It's the Gulf countries and Saudi Arabia. All of this is being funded by them. Everybody who's been radicalized by Islam has been radicalized either in a mosque that's funded by Iranians or a mosque funded by Saudis. So The whole attitude is so ridiculous. And the source of all this, and I've got 1 minute to get to my punchline. The source of all this is philosophical. We in America today are so dominated by altruism, so dominated by meekness, so dominated by an anti-self-interest attitude to foreign policy. But to life generally, foreign policy is just a manifestation, to life generally, that we are willing to watch our countrymen die, to watch our friends die, to watch our neighbors die, and do nothing, nothing. Just stand by and turn the other cheek. Pretend that it didn't happen. We're so afraid of taking a stand. We're so afraid of actually declaring an enemy and going after them. Imagine if all we did in World War II is ban Nazi immigrants. Now, I'm fine with banning Islamic Muslim immigrants if we declare war and we say when the war's over, just like I'm sure we banned German immigration into the United States during World War II. That's fine. But there was a war. Declare it, go fight it, and win it. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Sorry for the technical difficulties. I'll see you same time, same place next week. This is the Iran Brooks Show.